Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Hey guys, and welcome back to my channel for another midweek mystery video, where this week we're looking into the strange death of Natalie Wood, a Hollywood celebrity, a star. Natalie Wood is probably someone you've heard of, not for her countless amounts of movies, but for her strange death. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the strange circumstances around her death, try and figure out whether we think it was actually an accident, as it was officially ruled, or if we do think there's something sinister, some foul play involved. Natalie Wood was actually born Natalia Zakharenko in San Francisco, California on the 20th of July 1938 to her parents Nikolai and Maria Zakharenko. They are both Russian immigrants, but they didn't actually meet in Russia. They actually moved over to the USA with their own families around the same time and happened to meet in California, and they hit it off. They end up getting married, and they have Natalia. And Natalia was often called Natasha as a child. That's kind of the Russian nickname for Natalia. As a child, Maria dreamed of becoming famous. She wanted to be an actress or a ballet dancer. And it seems like she just transferred all of these dreams onto Natalia as soon as she was born, because obviously Maria never achieved these dreams herself. And so she was determined that little Natalia was going to become a star. She was that typical stage mum, dragging her daughter left, right and centre to all of these different auditions for anything. Natalia was going to be famous. The family really struggled for money, and Maria was convinced if she could just get Natalia to become a star, then they'd never have to worry about money again, and that is kind of what ended up happening. Later on, the family actually changed their surname to Gurdin, which was just a little bit more Americanized. I think it was Maria's maiden name, so Natalia became Natalia Gurdin. As a child, Maria would take Natalia to the cinema as much as she could, and Natalia was basically raised on these old Hollywood movies, and this was the only kind of lesson that Natalia ever got in acting, just by watching all of these movies constantly. Natalie would go on to say years later that my mother used to tell me that the cameraman who pointed his lens out at the audience at the end of the Paramount newsreel was taking my picture. I'd pose and smile like he was going to make me famous or something. I believed every word my mother told me. When Natalia was a toddler, the family actually moved to Santa Rosa, and she just happens to be noticed one day by a film crew that's shooting in downtown Santa Rosa. No doubt her mother had purposely dragged her down there to see if she could get spotted, and it worked out because she did. And so at just the age of 4, Natalia Gurdin starts acting professionally. She first appears in a short scene in a film called Happy Land. And Natalia was the dream child actress. She was a rule follower, so she would just do anything the director told her to do. And she'd always do it with a smile on her face as well. She was easy to work with. And this meant that the director on this shoot, Irving Pichel or Pichel, actually remembered her, and he remained in contact with Natalia's family, advising them whenever a new child role was up for grabs. Eventually, when Natalia was about 7, Maria packed her whole family up and moves them to Los Angeles because they need to be closer to where all the action is. As little Natalia starts to work more and more in the industry, it's actually recommended that she changes her name, and the studio producer who recommended this chooses the name for her, Natalie Wood. It was more media-friendly, Americanized name. And Natalie would say years later that she just wasn't a fan of the name Natalie Wood. I mean, she quite liked Natalie. It was very similar to her name Natalia. but she hated the name Wood as it just didn't give a nice image to her, but she didn't really have a choice. At this time as well, the family had a second daughter who they named Svetlana Gurdin. She would go on to become an actress as well, known as Lana Wood. Natalie's first big acting role comes in a film called Tomorrow is Forever, where she plays a German orphan opposite Orson Welles and Claudette Colbert. Orson Welles would actually comment on how amazing Natalie was on set. She was so good that she was terrifying. And then at this point, she's like a very young child. For this role, Natalie had to be able to cry on cue. And apparently Maria stood behind the cameras and was shouting at Natalie, telling her to think of the death of her dead dog. And this worked. Natalie did start crying, but this wasn't enough. Maria, who then takes Natalie behind sort of the scenes and pulls out a jar in which there's a butterfly. She pulls the butterfly out of the jar and starts ripping off its wings. And Natalie was an animal lover, very like tender-hearted, and just starts sobbing. And Maria then grabs Natalie by the arm, drags her back around to the set, throws her on, and says, okay, she's ready, start shooting. As talented as Natalie was, she was an amazing actress. She never kind of had a choice, like she had to do this. It was after this that Natalie scored potentially her biggest role of all time, arguably definitely her most famous, Miracle on 34th Street opposite Maureen O'Hara. This shot her to stardom and she became one of the most sought after child stars in Hollywood. All in all, she starred in over 20 films as a child. And she definitely by no means had your standard childhood. Like, she was on movie sets all the time. She never really had a standard schooling. The rule in Hollywood at the time was that child stars had to spend at least 3 hours a day schooling. So Natalie said that she would be in her trailer doing her like schooling and she'd be just itching to get back to set because she knew that everyone would be waiting for her to finish. And she was actually doing amazing all these movie sets and she was a straight A student. And she was actually known as One Take Natalie because she was well known in the industry for being able to do whatever she needed to do in just one shot. One of the most important and foreboding things to know about Natalie Wood is that she had a lifelong fear of water, specifically dark water, oceans. When Natalie was a child, Maria had actually gone to see a psychic who warned her that Natalie would have to be careful around dark water. And I don't know if this was sort of like the beginning of her fear. I don't know if as a child Maria would always say to Natalie, like, be careful of dark water. But this is something she would later go on to say, that a psychic had told her this. It's reported that Natalie, as an adult, wouldn't even go swimming in her own swimming pool. But a lot of sources say that it was specifically just dark water that she was scared of. At the age of 43, Natalie Wood would go on to drown in the ocean. When she was shooting 1948's The Green Promise as a child, Natalie had to film a scene where she was walking over a bridge during a thunderstorm. And the bridge was supposed to collapse as soon as Natalie reached the other end. However, one of the technicians on set flicked a switch too early and the bridge collapses with Natalie still on it and she goes falling into the water below and she actually ends up breaking her wrist. Her mother pushes her to finish the rest of the production without seeking any medical help, but Natalie obviously had a broken wrist, it didn't set properly and she was left with this lump on her wrist for the rest of her life. And a few years later in the 1952 film The Star, where she was starring opposite Bette Davis, she actually had to film a scene where she jumps over the railing of a private yacht. And Natalie told the like producers of her fear and they assured her that there was absolutely no danger. There was men in rowboats there to pick her up as soon as she sort of fell into the water. And it took a lot of persuading, but Natalie eventually films the scene and she's screaming in terror as she lands in the water. And Bette Davis was so traumatised by just having to watch Natalie face her like worst fear that she actually turned around and said that she was going to refuse to finish the production if the producers didn't find somebody else, a body double, to do the scene in Natalie's place. And so that's eventually what ends up happening. Only the body double does the scene, gets entangled in kelp, and actually nearly dies on set. And then years later, the fear actually crops up again when she's filming 1961's Splendor in the Grass. Now, there's a really important scene in the film which takes place in a reservoir. And Natalie asked the director, a man called Elia Kazan, if they could actually film it in a sort of pool in a studio. But the director said no because he wanted Natalie's fear in the scene to be realistic. Directors can just be horrible sometimes, and pushed her to do it anyway. So Natalie, ever the professional, did do the scene in the end, but apparently afterwards she leapt out of the water, shivering and crying in fear. So like I said, in her childhood, Natalie starred in about 20 films in total. Eventually, she begins to grow out of child stardom, and she wants to distance herself from the cute child star stereotype. I mean, she's a 16-year-old teenager wearing frilly dresses and pigtails, still trying to play younger characters. It just wasn't her anymore. In 1956, she graduates high school and she signs with Warner Brothers. And at this point, she starts being cast in girlfriend after girlfriend role. She is now officially the teenage girlfriend. But at the age of 16, she's actually cast in Rebel Without a Cause, opposite James Dean. The entire film, I don't know if you've seen it, is about teenage rebellion, basically, and it was the perfect role for Natalie at this time. The director, Nicholas Ray, was really hesitant to give Natalie the part of Judy, who was a teenage girl being ignored by her father acting out, because he saw Natalie as still this cute child star. He was concerned that she was way too innocent for the role. However, this didn't stop 44-year-old Nicholas actually sleeping with 16-year-old Natalie at the time. But even this didn't steal the role for her. Until she's on a drunken night out one night and she actually gets into a car crash. Nicholas goes rushing to the hospital where Natalie is absolutely fine, but the doctor in front of Nicholas calls her a goddamn juvenile delinquent. And Natalie apparently yelled out, "Did you hear what he called me, Nick? He called me a goddamn juvenile delinquent. Now do I get the part?" And she did. While she's on set, she continues sleeping with Nicholas Ray, but she's also sleeping as well with her co-star, Dennis Hopper. She's desperately trying to shed this child star image, but also she's just a teenager going through her rebellious phase. So she's just acting out a little bit, it seems. Her role on Rebel Without a Cause actually goes on to get her first ever Oscar nomination, which she doesn't win, but it's a huge thing just to be nominated. As she gets older, she kind of gets caught between these teenage and adult roles. She was in this odd in-between where nobody could really cast her in anything. It was kind of a transition period for her. And around this time, any film that she was in would just end up getting horrific reviews. And by this point, she's like in her late teens, early 20s, and people are referring to her as a washed up actress. But then in 1961, Elia Kazan actually takes a chance, he said, on Natalie and casts her in his film Splendor in the Grass opposite Warren Beatty. He said, "When I saw her, I detected behind the well-mannered young wife front a desperate twinkle in her eyes. I talked with her more quietly then and more personally. I wanted to find out what human material was there, what her inner life was. Then she told me that she was being psychoanalyzed. That did it. Poor RJ, I said to myself. I liked Bob Wagner, I still do." RJ Wagner actually refers to Robert Wagner, who was Natalie's husband by this point. She'd met him on her 18th birthday, they'd gone for a date, they'd been set up by the studio. There was an 8-year age gap between the two, so RJ Wagner, or Robert Wagner, was actually 26 years old at the time. Two young stars in a romantic relationship was incredible press for the studio at this time, and it was just so lucky for them that Natalie and Robert genuinely really liked each other. They had a whirlwind romance and actually ended up getting married on December 29th, 1957. Natalie was just 19 years old. Natalie said that she'd first set her sights on Robert many, many years earlier when she was just 10 years old. She was walking down a hall at 20th Century Fox and 18-year-old at the time, Robert Wagner, was walking in her direction and she turns to her mum and says, "I'm going to marry him." Can't say she didn't stay true to her words. By the time Natalie started working on Splendor in the Grass, she'd been married to RJ for about 3 years, but rumours started flying around that she was having an affair with her co-star Warren Beatty. Still to this day, it seems like there's a lot of debate as to whether this affair actually happened or not, and I genuinely couldn't really get a straight answer on the internet. They definitely had a romance, there's no denying this, but whether it started to happen before the end of her marriage or after is a little bit iffy. I did actually read an interesting tidbit that said that the studio reportedly knew that Natalie and Warren were having an affair or just liked each other, but they didn't put a stop to it because it just added to the chemistry on screen. Apparently RJ would always turn up to the studios, seemingly keeping an eye on Natalie, his jealousy getting the better of him. which may or may not have been justified depending on whether her and Warren were having an affair at this time or not. Regardless of all the rumours, the movie worked out really well for the studio and Natalie received another Oscar nomination, along with nominations for the Golden Globes and the BAFTAs as well. Her marriage, however, wasn't doing quite so well because her and RJ ended up splitting officially in June 1961 before getting divorced the following year. And at this point, after the divorce, she starts openly dating Warren Beatty. But their relationship actually ended in legendary Hollywood style. They're actually in a restaurant in Hollywood when Warren gets up to take a phone call and never returns, leaving it to the restaurant manager to go over to Natalie, who sat there on her own, to say that Warren's actually just seduced the Hatchet girl and convinced her to quit her job and leave with him. So their relationship didn't end on the best of terms. That same year, she ends up playing Maria in West Side Story, which is probably another one of her most well-known roles. And then also she's in Gypsy. In 1964, she receives her third Oscar nomination for Love with a Proper Stranger, making her the youngest person ever at the time to receive three Oscar nominations. She's just 25 years old. That record would later go on to be broken by Jennifer Lawrence and Saoirse Ronan, who both received three Oscar nominations by the age of 23. In the next few years, post-divorce, Natalie just works hard at her movie. She focuses everything on doing her work. She was reportedly heartbroken over her divorce from Robert, as was the rest of the nation, because the media portrayed Natalie and RJ as the perfect couple, the happiest couple in Hollywood. So it was a shock to everyone when they got divorced. Whilst most of Natalie's films were commercially profitable, there was actually a lot of debate as to whether she was actually a good actress or not. Most directors said that she was an absolute joy to work with, she was always the best choice for the part, she was just a genuinely lovely person. But one year in 1966, she actually wins the Harvard Lampoon Award for the worst actress. She had good humour about it though and actually turns up in person, the first actress ever to turn up in person to collect this award. It seems during these years that she struggled a lot with her mental health. I mean, as you could probably imagine, there was a lot on her. She was one of the most sought after actresses in Hollywood and I can imagine she was probably pretty burnt out. She was romantically linked in this time and before her marriage as well with some of the biggest stars in the USA. I'm talking James Dean, Frank Sinatra, even Elvis Presley. In these years, she reportedly once takes an overdose of barbiturates after an unexpected visit from Warren Beatty, who pretty much broke her heart completely. And Warren wanted her to star opposite him in Bonnie and Clyde, but she turned down the role, she didn't want to do it, and it ended up going to Faye Dunaway. After the overdose, she's rushed to hospital where she has her stomach pumped, and she says that for a moment she didn't want to live, but now she does. And then on May 30th, 1969, Natalie actually marries Richard Gregson, who she'd been dating for about 2.5 years. In 1970, they have a daughter, Natasha Gregson, named after Natalie's childhood nickname. Around this time, Natalie actually goes into a semi-retirement. She wants to focus on raising her daughter as much as she can, so she starts turning down the majority of the films that she's offered. She does, however, start to focus more on television. Natalie and Richard end up divorcing in April 1972 after she discovers that he's been cheating on her. However, before their divorce is even finalised, Natalie has already rekindled her relationship with RJ Wagner. Just 5 months after reconciling, they remarry. The two actually remarry aboard a 55-foot yacht called the Ramblin' Rose off of Malibu's Paradise Cove. Their entire relationship seems to be intertwined with boats, RJ saying the first time he realised he was in love with Natalie was whilst they were aboard a boat on a date. Natalie said of her second marriage to RJ, "When RJ and I were married the first time, we were like two children acting out a studio script. We deliberately hid our weaknesses from each other. Now we found that we could really talk to each other. We were not afraid to be ourselves, but we realised that we needed those years apart to reach that understanding." In 1974, their first child together is born, Courtney. They were now a family of five: Natalie, RJ, Natasha, Robert's daughter Kate from a marriage that he had whilst they were broken up, and now Courtney as well. And Robert actually raised Natasha as his own from when she was about 1 year old, and she refers to him as her dad. Work once again begins to take a backseat for Natalie because she wants to raise her children and she wants to be a wife. She's already lived that Hollywood dream. Now she wants to just relax a little bit and she has other priorities. But alongside this, she was finding it hard as well to find good roles because she was headed into her 40s. She was past her prime. She could no longer play the young love interest to these 40-year-old Hollywood men, but she was too young at this point to be playing the family matriarch. I mean, it probably says something about the patriarchy in Hollywood that it's 40-year-old men whose love interests are 22-year-old females, but we'll save that for another video. The two would remain married this time until Natalie's death on November 29th, 1981, when she's just 43 years old. I've already mentioned Natalie's lifelong fear of dark water in this video. It's something that is very well documented about the actress. However, it seems to me that it may have been slightly over-exaggerated over time. Whilst Natalie did indeed have a fear of this dark water, she loved boats, and her and Robert RJ spent a lot of time on boats throughout their relationship. They actually had their own 60-foot yacht called Splendor, named after Natalie's movie Splendor in the Grass, which is one thing that leads me to believe that Natalie and Warren probably didn't have an affair whilst they're on the set of that movie, because then why would RJ go on to name his boat after the movie that potentially broke down their marriage. The family would spend loads of time on this boat, either all together or RJ and Natalie would throw celebrity parties for all of their friends. At the time of her death, Natalie was working on a film called Brainstorm, starring Christopher Walken. She'd already filmed most of her major scenes by the time of her death, and the film was eventually released a couple of years later, with Natalie's younger sister Lana Wood standing in for the actress when she needed to. It was November of 1981, it was Thanksgiving, and Natalie invited a load of the people on the film set to come and spend Thanksgiving with them in Catalina on the Splendor. Most people declined, the only person to accept their offer was Christopher Walken. There have been many rumours flying around in the years since Natalie's death that Natalie and Christopher were having an affair, but it's just a rumour. I don't think that this ever actually happened. Lana Wood said after Natalie's death that Natalie may have fancied him. Everyone fancied Christopher Walken apparently at the time, and maybe Natalie wished she could have him, but nothing ever materialised. Her and RJ were in a genuinely very happy marriage. Now, when the incident first happened, when Natalie drowned, the following that I'm about to tell you was the official version of events. Natalie was on her yacht just off of Catalina Island with RJ and Christopher Walken, and the captain of the ship as well, a man called Dennis Deverne. Now, that evening, Robert was on board the boat and he found a note saying that she had taken the dinghy with Christopher and they'd headed to a restaurant on the island, and would RJ like to join them? So RJ takes a shoreboat and heads to meet them, where they all spend the night drinking. They were drinking for the mid-afternoon and ended up leaving the restaurant about 10:30 p.m. and between them they consumed a couple of bottles of champagne. And when they left, the entire group was pretty drunk enough for the restaurant manager to actually call the person working at the harbour to say, like, hey, these people are quite drunk, can you ensure they actually get back on their boat safely? Which they do. But that night, when they get back on the boat, RJ and Natalie have an argument. They'd both been drinking, and Robert was apparently mad because he thought that Natalie had been flirting with Christopher. And this leads to RJ and Christopher having their own argument between them. And at one point, RJ's so mad that he picks up a wine bottle and smashes it on the table, breaking it into pieces. And he would later tell the police that this wine bottle broke because of the really rough seas, because he didn't want to admit that he was the one who smashed it. Because that just makes someone look a little bit suspicious when your wife suddenly dies a few hours later. Natalie apparently that night took herself to bed around 11:45 p.m. and this was the last time that either of them admit to seeing her alive. Eventually Robert goes to check on Natalie and finds that she's not in her room. He has a look around the boat for her. It's not a huge boat, like, it's a yacht, but it's not one of those like massive ones that you think of. It's just a standard yacht. So he has a look around for her, can't find her, but sees that the dinghy is also gone. And I'm not talking about one of those like little tiny blow up rubber dinghies. It's a proper dinghy, like electric, it's got a motor on it and stuff, but it's one that you sort of like untie and you can sort of sail to the shore. And he sees that this dinghy is gone, and he assumes that Natalie's got bored of all the arguments because RJ and Christopher were still arguing, and has just decided to take the dinghy to shore by herself. Now, Natalie was scared of dark water, but she really liked sailing. So this isn't completely out of the realm of possibility here. He waits about 10 to 15 minutes and Natalie doesn't return. So Robert goes to look for her aboard a small cruiser boat. A radio call for help is made at approximately 1:30 a.m. So he waited quite a while after he realised that Natalie was gone to call for help. But I suppose if he thought that she'd gone to shore, then why would he think that she needed help immediately? So he called at 1:30 a.m, but the Coast Guard weren't actually alerted until 3:30 a.m, nearly 4 hours after she was last seen. Now, a lot of reports state that Robert didn't call for help until 3:30, but from what I gather, this wasn't true. Robert called for help originally at 1:30, and the Coast Guard were told at 3:30. Although still, to wait over an hour before calling for help for your potentially missing wife is still a little bit questionable. And this is something that could have very different connotations depending on sort of like what angle you look at it from. I mean, if he thought that Natalie had just got in the boat and gone to shore, as she had done before, then why would you immediately think to call the Coast Guard for help? Like, he just assumed that she'd gone to shore and was staying in a hotel there. But if you're looking at it from an angle of suspicion, this raises some huge questions. Why wouldn't you immediately call for help? Sadly, Natalie's body is found just before 8 a.m. She's floating face down in the water about a mile from the boat, as she's seen from the air by a sheriff's department helicopter. The dinghy is actually found beached very nearby, with the key in the ignition, in neutral gear, and the oars tied down. It didn't look like anybody had actually used the boat. LA County lifeguards and private searchers were the first ones to reach the body, and they pull her from the water, pronouncing her dead at 7:44 a.m. As she's pulled out of the water, she's wearing a flannel nightgown and socks, and she was wearing a jacket, a very heavy parka jacket, while she was in the water, but as she was dragged out, this jacket comes off. None of the clothes were torn or bloody, and she wasn't wearing underwear. At the time she was pulled from the water, rigor mortis hadn't quite set in, but it had by the time that she'd reached the morgue. They noted foam coming from her mouth, and there are a number of bruises on her arms and legs, but no other trauma or foul play was immediately noted. RJ couldn't bring himself to identify the body of his now dead wife, and so he sends Dennis DeVerne, the captain of the ship, to do it instead. Her autopsy was really interesting to read. It will be linked down below in all of the sources. But something I found really, really interesting in the autopsy was that it was noted that the left wrist is slightly deformed on the lateral condyle of the ulna, and it is very prominent. So basically, like I mentioned earlier, Natalie broke her wrist whilst on a movie set as a kid. Her mother refused to get her help, and so it didn't heal properly, leaving her with this huge lump. And it was sort of like significant enough to be noted in the autopsy. Natalie throughout her life would always wear loads and loads of bracelets to cover up this lump. She had multiple fresh bruises all over her right and left lower legs. Most of them were approximately 1/2 inch to 1 inch in diameter. And there were some bigger bruises on her left knee and right ankle as well, about 2 inches wide. When the medical examiner opened up her stomach, there was a strong, strong smell of alcohol and 2 large vitamin pills as well, undissolved. She was found to have a blood alcohol level of 0.14%, and the legal driving limit in California at the time was 0.1%. So she was pretty drunk. There were also traces of 2 different types of medication found in her bloodstream. One was a motion sickness pill and the other was a painkiller, both of which would have increased the effects of alcohol. The opinion of the medical examiner was that the autopsy findings were consistent with accidental drowning in the ocean. The time of death was pretty difficult to pinpoint due to the nature of the incident, but they guessed it was most likely around midnight, just 15 minutes after Natalie was last seen at around 11:45. He said most of the bruises on the body were superficial and they were probably sustained at the time of drowning. The police released a statement saying that the cause of death was accidental drowning and that Natalie accidentally ended up in the water after potentially slipping. A few days after the death, a woman comes forward to say that she was on a nearby boat at the time and heard a woman screaming for help on the evening that Natalie died. What really happened that night in November 1981 has become one of Hollywood's most enduring mysteries, with many people refusing to believe the police's version of events. Neither Christopher Walken or RJ Wagner were ever considered people of interest in this at all, because it was never ruled that foul play was involved. Robert was reportedly a huge mess after Natalie died. He was completely and utterly distraught about it, and anybody who knew him would back this fact up. Many people say that there's no way he could have been involved purely because of his reaction to it. He was left with 3 young children to look after. He later said, "If I'd been there, I could have done something. I wasn't. I would have done anything in the world to protect her. Anything. I lost a woman I loved with all of my heart." He wrote in his memoir years later that it was only after he was told what she was wearing that night that it occurred to him what exactly had happened. So here is RJ Wagner's theory as to what happened to Natalie that night. He said she was dressed in a sleeping gown, heavy socks and a parka. Natalie always had trouble sleeping with a dinghy slamming up against the boat. She probably skidded on one of the steps after untying the ropes. The steps are as slick as ice because of the algae and the seaweed that's always clinging to them. After slipping on the step, she hit her head against the boat. I only hope that she was unconscious when she hit the water. Could this be what really happened? Could Natalie have been lying in bed, she couldn't sleep because this dinghy was just banging up against the side of the boat, and Christopher and RJ were arguing and she's lying there and it's a rainy and windy night and she decides just to go out and untie this bloody dinghy. So she throws a coat over the top of her bedclothes and heads outside. She doesn't want to ask the men for help. She's annoyed at them. They're arguing over her. And she just wants to go to bed. So she's trying to untie it. And potentially she unties it the entire way. And maybe the dinghy falls or she slips. And she ends up falling into the water. She desperately tries to claw her way onto the dinghy. The dinghy was found to have scratch marks on the side. But she's panicking. She's terrified of water. And she can't get in the boat. She's swallowing water and eventually she just succumbs to the ocean. Perhaps she calls out for help while she's panicking, which is what the people on the nearby boat heard. But you do question why nobody on the boat heard. Honestly, to me, I think this sounds like a pretty solid theory, but we're not at the end of the story yet. For many years, both RJ and Christopher refused to speak about the events of that night, with Christopher opening up many years later, saying what happened that night, only she knows, because she was alone. She had gone to bed before us and her room was at the back. A dinghy was bouncing against the side of the boat and I think she went out to move it. There was a ski ramp that was partially in water. It was slippery. I'd walked on it myself. She told me she couldn't swim. In fact, they had to cut a swimming scene from Brainstorm. She was probably half asleep and she was wearing a coat. And the police agreed with this. Natalie's death was ruled an accidental drowning and the case was closed. Until 2011, which was approaching the 30th anniversary of Natalie's death, the case was reopened. It was actually reopened after Dennis DeBurn, the captain of the ship and on board that night, wrote a book in which he admitted to lying about the events of that night. He said he made mistakes by not telling the police the honest truth. Because of this new information, they decided to reopen the investigation and they're very much still looking into it. As of just last year, February 2018, the police made a point to say that Robert Wagner was a person of interest in the case, by no means a suspect, but he was a person of interest. Spokesman for RJ Wagner said, although no one in the Wagner family has heard from the LA County Sheriff's Department about this matter, they fully support the efforts of the LA County Sheriff's Department and trust that they will evaluate whether any new information relating to the death of Natalie Wood is valid and that it comes from a credible source or other sources other than those simply trying to profit from the 30-year anniversary of her tragic death. Dennis had recently co-authored a book about Natalie called Goodbye Natalie, Goodbye Splendor, in which he admitted that he lied and said that the arguments aboard the yacht that night were a lot more serious than the police had been originally led to believe. He said that he believed Robert was responsible for Natalie's death and that Robert told him not to make any steps to locate Natalie after she fell off the boat, and that they agreed on what they were going to tell the police. Dennis said that he fully believed that RJ pushed Natalie off the boat that night. However, 2 months after reopening the case, the police actually made a point to say that they'd found no new evidence whatsoever to dispute the original findings. So Dennis's version for events for that night in November 1981 was that there was a huge fight on the back of the deck between Natalie and Robert. Dennis said that he heard them fighting, but they were a married couple, he didn't want to get involved, so he just turns up the music really, really loud to try and like cover the sound so any like neighbouring boats couldn't hear it and then go to the media and profit off it. So he says that he just loved everyone, just wanted everyone to be happy and okay. But then suddenly everything goes quiet. So Dennis decides to head to the back of the deck immediately to see what's going on. And he arrives at the back of the deck to find Robert standing nervously and he's shaking and says, Natalie's missing, go look for her. And so Dennis did. Dennis said that he attempted to call for help and to turn on the searchlight, but Robert said not to. Apparently, Robert just takes him back into one of the rooms and they start drinking scotch, waiting until an hour had passed to do anything. Apparently, he'd also had a fight with Christopher earlier in the night when he shouted, "Do you want to fuck my wife?" before smashing the wine bottle. Dennis later did a polygraph test to talk about his version of events that night, and according to him, he passed with flying colours. Witnesses apparently came forward after all this came out to back up Dennis's claim, saying that they'd seen a man and woman arguing on the back of the boat that night. But I do always find it questionable when it takes witnesses so long to come forward. I mean, why not say this at the time? Why wait until 30 years have passed? It makes no difference to them. And a lot of people question as to why it took Dennis so long to come forward with his version of events as well. Dennis said that apparently he lived with RJ for about a year after Natalie's death. Reportedly, he wanted to take Dennis under his wing. And this apparently made it really hard for Dennis to talk to his own friends and family. Like, he couldn't get out of this, like, RJ Wagner bubble. RJ gets Dennis a job at the TV studio where he was working on the TV series Heart to Heart. Apparently a driver would pick Dennis up in the morning, take him to work and then take him home. And apparently when Dennis would go to his bedroom at night, the door would automatically lock, meaning he couldn't get out. A very creepy, weird situation to be in, I'm sure, if this is the truth. Something I note though is that I haven't found any other report of Robert RJ Wagner being particularly creepy in any way, or even violent. I mean, he did remarry years after Natalie died. Not any of his wives, he's had three wives, have ever reported that he was violent in any way. So could this completely non-violent man then go on to kill Natalie? One theory is that Natalie got bored and frustrated with the argument going on between Christopher and RJ, and so she decides to ride the dinghy to the shore herself. But Dennis very much disputes this. Dennis says that there's no reason why Natalie wouldn't have come to him and asked him to come to shore with her. Apparently they were really, really close and he loved Natalie and she knew that, and she knew that he would do anything for her. But considering how drunk Natalie was at the time and how angry she would have been, I doubt her first thought would have been like, oh, I'm gonna go get Dennis. Her first thought would have been like, I'm just getting out of here. And you know when you're so drunk that you just like have a one-track mind, you're just like, I'm just gonna do this, I'm gonna walk away, I'm gonna get out of this situation. Natalie probably didn't think about any consequences of what she was doing, she just wanted to leave this bloody boat. In 2013, they actually amended Natalie's death certificate to change the official cause of death from accidental drowning to drowning and other undetermined factors. The amended document included a statement saying that the circumstances of how Natalie ended up in the water are not clearly established. The coroner's office has been instructed not to discuss or comment on this case at all. They're not allowed. A 10-page addendum was also added to the autopsy report to note all of these things about the bruising, saying that the bruises on her body may have been sustained before she went in the water. This is all brand new evidence. But this couldn't be 100% determined that they were definitely caused before she got into the water. But apparently Natalie took a particular drug that made her more susceptible to bruising, so it didn't take much to bruise her. So even if these bruises were caused before she got in the water, it doesn't mean they were necessarily caused by any kind of brute force. Before I started my research into this case, I was convinced that there was foul play involved in this, that somebody had deliberately caused harm to Natalie. The way this case has been presented in Hollywood over the years is that it's this huge mystery and we'll never really know the truth. And I suppose we won't ever really know entirely what happened that night. But I don't actually think now, having looked into this case, that the original reports were too far off the mark. Honestly, if Dennis had just gone to the police years later with his version of events, I'd be more inclined to believe him. But he didn't. He didn't go to the police. He wrote it all in a book. And it just seems to me like it's a desperate grab for money coming up to the 30th anniversary of Natalie's death. Reportedly over the years, he went to talk about his events of that night multiple times, but his co-author always said to him not to and to wait until the book was released. It just seems to me like he wants attention for the book. He only spoke to the police once they approached him after hearing about his version of events through the book. Lana Wood said that she does not believe that her sister died as a result of foul play, but she also doesn't believe that RJ Wagner has been entirely honest about the events that night. I cannot ever believe that RJ had purposely done something to hurt her. I believe it was drink and people being out of control and not thinking clearly and just high emotions. And then she was asked if she believed that RJ potentially left her purposely in the water that night for punishment, which I'll speak about in a second. And she replied, if that's the case, he's probably been punished all of these years, as that would be a hell of a thing to live with. As this suggests, another potential theory here is that Robert and Natalie were having an argument on the deck and Natalie ends up falling in. Potentially fell in herself, potentially was pushed by RJ. I doubt he would have intentionally pushed her overboard, but maybe things just got physical. In a moment of drunken anger, RJ pushes Natalie overboard and he decides to leave her in the water as a punishment, knowing this is her biggest fear, but she's been flirting with Christopher Walken all night and he's not having any of it. Now this is where I'm a little bit confused, because in one version of events it seems like Dennis turned up on the back deck and Robert just said, like, oh, Natalie's gone missing. But in another, it seemed like Dennis knew that Natalie had gone overboard and RJ said to leave her there and teach her a lesson. So I'm not entirely sure on that. But this theory suggests that Natalie was overboard, she was in the water, and RJ decided to leave her for a little bit. And potentially when he went to rescue her, it was too late. The current was really bad that night. It was very rainy, very windy, and she would have been taken away so quickly. But again, it's no secret that the two of them had a very happy marriage. They had their arguments like all couples did, but I doubt he would have wished her dead. Like, if she had fallen in the water, he most likely would have immediately pretty much helped her out, because that's what you do if your wife is at risk of drowning. They argued, but does that mean that he's gonna murder her? I just don't see it. This also doesn't explain how the dinghy ended up in the water either, apart from if maybe RJ was trying to cover up his tracks and so he threw the dinghy in afterwards. Or maybe that was part of how he was going to save Natalie. Natalie was in the water, he couldn't go in there without like drowning himself, so he throws the dinghy into the water so she can sort of try and claw her way onto it, which of course she could never do. And of course this wouldn't mean that RJ had done anything wrong. If Natalie fell into the water, she fell into the water. But maybe he felt so guilty about not being able to jump in and help her that he's never been completely honest about the version of events. RJ has said that he feels immense guilt over the events of that night. I mean, perhaps he feels guilty for not checking on her in her room sooner and not realising she's gone. Perhaps he feels guilty that she fell overboard and he couldn't help her, or that he accidentally pushed her overboard, or perhaps that he did it on purpose. I mean, do I potentially think that both him and Christopher Walken know more about that night than they've ever let on? Yes. Do I think that means they murdered her? Not necessarily. On March 28, 2017, a case file was actually compiled with assistance from the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, which provided potential new clues into the death. The main finding in this file was apparently that the actress could have potentially been choked, strangled on board the boat, and then pushed overboard. Again, this isn't 100% confirmed, it's kind of just theories being flown around, but it has been said that this is a potential cause of death. Although I do think if she was like choked, strangled, and she bruised very easily, there would have been pretty obvious bruising around her neck in the original autopsy. Perhaps the saddest part of this entire case is that Natalie probably could have survived if she wasn't wearing her coat. She was wearing a very heavy parka because it was very cold outside. If she had fallen into the water and taken the jacket off, she most likely would have been able to float and survive, potentially make her way up onto the dinghy. The coat was so heavy that it just weighed her down. Perhaps if she was sober as well, she would have thought to remove the jacket, but she was drunk, and when you're in the water and it's freezing cold, you don't think to remove layers. A lot of people wonder that if Natalie fell off the yacht, then why didn't she just crawl back onto the yacht instead of onto the dinghy? The place from which she likely fell was actually quite close to the steps up onto the yacht, and she could have grabbed onto these and got back up on. But there's kind of two theories around this. The first one is that she was so angry at her husband that she just didn't want to get back on the boat, which I do find unlikely given that she hated the water, so I don't think she would have cared in the moment about being back on the boat with her husband. She would have been alive. But the second theory is that the current was so strong that night that she would have been swept away before she even had a chance. Maybe she did try and cling on to the dinghy, but it was very cold, she would have got hypothermia pretty quickly, and she would have fallen unconscious and just lost all of her strength. The boat would have made sure just a few minutes later. If she just hung on to the boat for just a couple of minutes longer, she would have made it to the shore with the dinghy, but she didn't. I don't think this case is going to go quiet anytime soon. It seems like a lot of people are very determined to get answers here. I don't think we're going to get them unless RJ and Christopher talk about their true version of events that night, or maybe they already have spoken about their true version of events and people are just determined that they haven't. Robert Wagner is actually in his 80s now, so he's getting pretty old, so I doubt that he's ever going to open up and speak about anything else about this case. I'm really intrigued to know what you guys think happened. I'm more inclined to believe that it was accidental. I do like the theory that the dinghy was banging off the side of the boat and she just wanted to go and fix the dinghy. But I do understand why people would have their hesitations about this. I'm intrigued to see if the cold case team come out with any more solid pieces of evidence to suggest that it was a murder. But I think the case is just so old now that facts are going to get a little bit twisted. Stories aren't going to be as straight as they would have been 30 plus years ago. Like I said, I would be a lot more inclined to believe Dennis's story if he hadn't written about it in a book to get money. If he'd gone to the police and said to them, like, I lied, I can't stop thinking about it, like, here is what really happened, then I probably would be more inclined to believe it. But It just doesn't seem believable.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.